Yeah, good morning. We have the exam not today, but next week, as I'm sure all you all know, just in case someone is panicking otherwise. Right, and we have the homework due only on Friday because last week we had the snowstorm and I wasn't sure whether everyone could have made it to Wednesday's lecture. So, are there any questions? Yeah?
The very last part?
Yes.
So you choose number C.
Yes.
And then you make it a pair. And then the pair.
Okay, not a pair. You look at the numbers between minus C and C.
Oh.
Okay, and on these numbers you define an operation. And this operation looks, if you haven't taken physics, this operation looks rather goofy. Why on earth should this be some addition? If you took some more advanced physics, you might recognize this, that this is the addition of speeds, the relativistic addition of speeds, of velocities. And velocities are bounded by the speed of light. So that's why we are only looking at numbers between minus C and C. And so the task there is basically to show that this addition is, well, or operate, that this operation is associative, which is a little bit yucky because you have to take three elements and you have to do it in both possible ways. And then identity is pretty clear. This will presumably be the speed zero, and inverses then also R should be rather easy. So the associativity there is the hard bit. In many cases, we don't need to do much work for associativity because it's a subset of something bigger where we already have shown that it's associative. So we've once shown basically that we have shown, for example, that matrix multiplication is associative. So if we have particular kinds of matrices, you know that it's associative. You don't need to show this from scratch. Other questions? You had one, no? You were moving towards a question.
Did I equal to S on your brother's
question? Okay, ID is the identity element in the group. S is the starting state of this machine, right?
Okay, I don't know.
So what you do is, you have the group consists of elements which can do certain symmetries, and now the machine does a certain sequence of symmetries. So the machine starts, the thing comes in, and if this thing comes in at this state S, which is just for the start state. S is the sensor test. So it tests, the thing comes in, let's suppose we have the stamp up here. Okay, and now we put this in some twisted way. Okay, so it comes, we test, do we have a stamp here? No, we do not. So we do operation B, which is a flip like this. We test, do we have a stamp here? Yes, we do. So we go and we say, yes, we accept it. Yeah?
Can you show me what an operation would be like where you do the multiplication like A times B?
Sure. So we have the thing in there. Okay. Now, if we do A times B, we would first do A. Yeah, you just did A. Thank you. with your paper. So we do A, and then we do B.
So is it backwards first?
No. It's not backwards first. We do.
So is the stamp facing you? Or?
Okay. I mean, it depends. It's not clear where the stamp is, right? The letters come in, people have thrown the letters in some arbitrary way in. So letters are, the only thing you can guarantee is that they are, that the long side is in this direction. So you don't have a letter sticking out like this. Okay. And now your goal is you want to basically bring the letter. There are four possible positions for the letter, right? And you want to have to test all four possible positions to make sure that you discover the stamp if it was on. And if there is a pro, if you have a product A times B, it just means first do A, then do B. And A was this operation and B was this one, I think, in the description. So, yeah, in this case, doing A and then B brings it there. But I can't just give a fixed, say I do once these operations, but I need to do a couple of operations and tests again, because I don't know how the letter was placed initially. Well, in some way you can say at the very start I even do the identity operation, but I'm not doing a sequence just of group operations, because then I would have to bring the letter always back in its original position, right? And that's certainly something which I don't need to do. That's unnecessary extra work. Yes, so what I could do is, if I would have a mechanism which always brings the letter back in the original position, I would just say I test these four elements and I'm done. But I don't have this. I have already, if I've done one test, if I've done already some operation, the letter is already in a different position. Right? And therefore I want then not to test, therefore I can't just say I test these four group elements. Okay? Other questions? No? Okay. So, what we did last time is we looked at permutations, and we used permutations to represent, for example, the symmetries of a triangle by labeling the corners of the triangle. And if you're wondering why was I labeling the corners and not the edges of the triangle, I could have done this as well. It doesn't really matter. Let's look at a somewhat different, but, oh, yeah, sorry. What I should say is, I probably didn't go into much detail. Why does this actually give me a group? I mean, I said these are the elements that we multiplied elements. Why is it giving me a group? What we have is, we have symmetries. They are maps from some object, in this case you could say the plane, to itself, and there are maps which are onto and one to one, and with this we simply mean that we don't squeeze something completely together, or we don't, and we can get every point. And if we take the composition of maps, this is always associative. And the proof that it is always associative is basically just looking at what is the composition of maps? I apply, the way it's defined, it follows basically automatically, because the composition is defined as first execute one map, then execute the other map, and then it really doesn't matter whether you put parentheses around. The parentheses basically are unimportant there, because the product is still defined as first the one, then the other, and therefore the parentheses don't matter. So composition of maps is always associative. In particular, that means also that multiplication of permutations, because they are a particular kind of maps, and their multiplication is just the composition of these maps, is associative. Okay. Let me go through a similar example. Let's look at the symmetries of a square. So I take a square, I label the corners 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. And now I want to look at what is the group of all symmetries. Again, I can describe symmetries by permutations. Permutations of 4 points, because if I know what happens with the corners, I know what happens with the square. Furthermore, I can observe that I can clearly map corner 1 to each of these positions, so I have 4 possibilities where I can move corner 1. The neighboring corner 2 then needs to be mapped to a neighboring corner, So if I map corner 1 to corner 3, I cannot map corner 2 to corner 1 because that wouldn't be neighboring. So I have then 2 neighboring corners, so I have 4 times 2, which is 8 possibilities. So I should expect 8 elements there. Okay, so what symmetries do I have? I have the trivial symmetry, the identity element. I always have this. I have a rotation by 90 degrees, and this rotation I can represent by this 4 cycles, so this is the 90 degree rotation. I can rotate 90 degrees the other way around, and that gives me 1, 4, 3, 2, and we can observe that this is the inverse permutation to this one. It should be because it's the inverse operation. If I first rotate right and then rotate left by the same amount, I'm back at the origin. So that's 1, 4, 3, 2. I can rotate by 180 degrees. That gives me that 1 goes to 3, 3 goes back to 1, and 2 and 4 swap their position. Okay, so this is the 180 degree rotation, and there it doesn't really matter whether I consider it right or left rotation. It gives me the same result. Okay, that's the rotations. Then I can do reflections. I can do reflections along a vertical axis. So I can do reflection along this axis. That will swap 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 at the same time. So 1 and 2 get swapped and 3 and 4 get swapped. I can do a reflection along this axis. Then 1 and 4 get swapped and 2 and 3 get swapped. And I can do 2 reflections on axes which go through the corners. Now, because 4 is even, axes through the corners are different than axes through the middle of the faces. So I get 2 more there. I get, if I take a reflection along this axis, this swaps 2 and 4. And if I take the reflection along this axis here, I get 1 and 3. 1 and 3 change their positions. Okay. And I can observe what I really should have here. I know I have permutations. The multiplication is associative. You can verify, though that would be not particularly exciting, that would be a bit tedious, that indeed any product of 2 such permutations lies again in the set. Let's just, for an example, let's say, what happens if I multiply 1, 4, 3, 2 with, say, this element with 1, 2, 3, 4? What do I get there? This is a 4. How do we multiply it? Just as a reminder, I go through. I start with 1. What happens with 1? 1 goes to 4. What happens with 4? Furthermore, 4 becomes 3. So 1 goes to 3. Next, what happens with 3? Because we want to write it in cycle form. 3 goes to 2. What happens with 2 here? 2 goes to 1. So I have 3 goes to 1, and I close the parenthesis. 2 hasn't been used yet. What happens with 2? 2 goes to 1, goes to 2. So I have just 2 itself. And since I don't write this cycle, I don't need to write it. 4, because my permutation is a map which is onto and 1 to 1, therefore has no other choice but to go to 4, and I said I won't write this down. And let's just check that this indeed agrees with what we were doing. This say I take a 90 degree rotation left, and I take this flip along this axis, and my claim is this is 1, 3. This should be the same as the reflection along this diagonal. Indeed, it is. Okay. And the advantage of using these permutations is simply that now it is much easier. It is easy to write down the elements. I don't need to invent names for my elements. Some books start with this example and they give fancy names to the elements. The other thing is, I can immediately, if I want to take a product of elements, I can just calculate it using the permutations. I don't need to take my model and see, oh, what would happen if I take rotation, reflection, another rotation or so, what happens there? I can just do it in the permutations on the board or on paper, which is easier to write down and to follow from the write-up. If I give you a product here by saying I do these things, you probably won't be happy having to write it down. And even if I would describe it with the symbols for this, I don't need to refer to the multiplication table because the multiplication table is getting big. Here I have an 8x8 multiplication table. So I have a table with 64 entries, and this isn't really a particularly large group. So that's the reason, or one reason, why I like describing this with permutations. Of course, going to examples with permutation. Oh, yeah, and I should say, so this is a group. And again, this group is not abelian. The multiplication does not commute, and you can just try it out. If you say, if you take this product, say, the other way around, you will see that you get something else, right? If we would first do the, let's do the multiplication. The other way around, if I take 1, 2, 3, 4, and I multiply this with 1, 4, 3, 2, what do I get there? 1 becomes 2, gets back to 1, stays fixed. 2 moves to 1 becomes 4, and 3 also, 4 goes back to 2, and 3 stays fixed if you multiply it. These are two different elements, so we see the multiplication is not commutative. This is not an abelian group. And again, the warning, that is in some way the typical thing. A lot of books are really misleading that a lot of their examples are abelian groups. But it's misleading, and the reason they do this is that they don't want to introduce permutation early, and they find it hard to give examples of non-commutative groups, of non-abelian groups, simply because they don't want to say, oh, how can I describe the elements? How can I describe the symmetries of a cube or so? I would need there, I have 24 rotations, so there I would really need to describe, write down a lot of elements and invent a lot of names. And therefore, their examples are abelian. But in general, groups are not abelian. And the vast majority of groups is not abelian. And that's why you might see this over time, that in some situations where I'm going to prove certain things, that it might look rather tedious, but it is because I can't assume that the multiplication is commutative. Okay, so that's the symmetries of the square. There is one more general example which I should mention since we introduced permutations. Namely, if I take all permutations, let's say, and this will be called S index N, this is all permutations on the set from 1 up to n, and this is called the symmetric group of degree n. So this is a set of all the permutations. How many permutations are there? I don't know whether you've seen this notation. This notation is used certainly in algebra, sometimes in other areas, to denote the number of elements in the set. So these bars on the side just say how many are there. Some people write instead a number symbol before, but it turns out that this here is actually a slightly more convenient notation. So this means the number of elements of the symmetric group Sn. How many are there? How many permutations are there on n elements? If you had combinatorics, you know the answer. It's n factorial, and the argument is basically very similar to the argument how I calculated it here. I don't have any restrictions how I can map elements, how depending on how previous elements were mapped. So I can map n. The only thing is I need to make it 1 to 1 and onto. So I can map 1 to n possibilities. Then I can map 2 to all possibilities but the one where I mapped 1. So I have n minus 1 possibilities. 3 similarly has n minus 2 possibilities and so forth. And this is all independent, so I can multiply it. So I get in total n factorial, which is just 1 times 2 times 3 times and so forth times n possibilities. And there you see that these numbers actually grow up rather quickly. If I have 5, the numbers 1 to 5, I have 120 possibilities. If I have the numbers 1 to 6, I have 720 possibilities. For 7, I have 5,040 possibilities. For 8, I have 40,320 possibilities. For 9, I don't remember the number in my head. But it goes up rather quickly. So it is not hard to describe really large groups. I mean, it depends whether you consider it large or so, but if your standard is writing down elements, this is certainly even 120 is large. I don't want to write down 120 permutations on the board. Okay, so this is also a group, right? Why it is not empty? Multiplication is associative because the multiplication is composition of mappings, and composition of mappings is always commutative. Not commutative, it's always associative. It is not commutative in general once the degree gets bigger than 2. I mean, for n equals 2, it's not that particularly exciting because I have just 2 permutations. And one of them is the identity. And there you just can figure out that they commute once n gets, so if n is greater or equal than 3, then Sn is not abelian. The identity is the identity permutation, which maps every point to itself, and the inverse is the inverse permutation. So this is a group, and is another example of a group. Okay. There is one further concept which is convenient to introduce at this point, namely the concept of order. Okay. And this actually is used in two ways. One is the order of the group, which is just the number of elements. So if G is a group, the order of G is the number of elements of G. That is also called order, but there also is the order of an element. And the order of an element, you can see in this example easily. Let's just see what happens if I repeat an operation. So let's say I do the 90 degree rotation. I do it once, I do it twice, 3 times, 4 times, and I'm back at the origin. Right? So if I do the 90 degree rotation 4 times, I'm back at the origin. If I do it a fewer number of times, unless I do it 0 times, I'm not back at the origin. So the order, if little g is an element in G, the order of little g is, and we denote it also with this bar symbol for order, the order of little g is the smallest positive n if such that g to the n is the identity element, if such an n exists, and otherwise it's infinity. And oh yeah, and we say n greater than 0, and we say it is 0 if g is, no sorry, not 0, the order is, no, that's fine, that follows automatically. The order is 1 if it's the identity element, but that follows here automatically. So I take the smallest n such that the nth power of the element g, and what is the nth power? This is just g, 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 and so forth, n times operated with itself. So, in this group of symmetries here, what can I tell about the orders? The identity has order 1, right? Because if I just do the identity, I'm back at the original place, so this has order 1. The 90-degree rotation I've just shown you has order 4. The 90-degree backwards rotation, by the same argument, I just turn around and then the backwards rotation also has order 4. 180-degree rotation has order 2, right? If I rotate twice by 180 degrees, I'm back at the origin. The reflections have order 2, and that holds for all of them. Okay. So that's the order, the definition of order of an element. And what you might observe here is my group has order 8, and all the element orders are divisors of 8. And that's not happenstance here, that's something which holds in general. And that is an important concept in group theory, which we will encounter again and again in the course. One of the driving ideas in group theory, which happens to work there, is to relate structural information about the group or about its elements to to number theoretic information about the number of elements or orders of elements. So this, we can't yet prove it. We are quite a bit away from proving it, but this will always hold. The orders here must be divisors, since the group has 8 elements, must be divisors of 8. Sn has order n factorial. The order of any element there must be divisor of n factorial, which is not that particularly hard because n factorial has really tons of factors. Okay, so that's the order of elements. What is worth mentioning, because this is not clear, it's not really immediately clear, it's a little bit of a step, is to note that if my group has finite order, every element must have a finite order. And why is this the case? Let me state this. It has a finite order, and it actually must be an order smaller than the order of the group. So theorem, let's suppose G is a group. Let's suppose the order of G is, let's say, M, which is not infinity. I have finitely many elements. Let's take an element little g in this group. Then I claim that the order of little g is at most M. So in particular, if the group is finite, the element order cannot be infinite. Why is this the case? I just consider the powers of little g. G, g squared, g cubed, and so forth. These are all elements of the group g, right? Because the group is closed under multiplication. So I have all elements of this group there. But my group just has finitely many elements. So if I write down more and more powers here, at some point I need to get, these can't be all different, right? Because I have at most m of these can be different by the pigeonhole principle. If I have m chairs and I want to sit more than m people on these chairs, on some chair, 2 people have to sit or more. So, these cannot be all different. Because the order of g is m is smaller than infinity. Okay, so let's look at the first case when two elements are the same. So assume g to the a is equal to g to the b, and I have that b is bigger than a, and b and a are chosen to be the first case, the first occurrence. B and a are minimal with this property. So I take the first time that two elements, that an element occurs again, right? And it must occur again because I just have finitely many choices. So let's say I have this situation. I know, because I have at most m different elements, I can deduce immediately that b can be at most m, right? That b can be at most, m plus 1. Right? Because if I write down m plus 1 elements, I must have a collision. Right? I can't squeeze m plus 1 people on m chairs. So, if I write down m plus 1 elements, I must have a collision, and this collision must be between some element, between two different elements. So the last element for which I can have a collision could be element number m plus 1. So b is at most m plus 1, and a I choose to be the smaller of the two numbers. Okay, but if I have this, now I use the fact that I have a group. Because I have a group, g has an inverse. Because the inverse of g exists, I can deduce from this. Okay, let me deduce this rather in the next column so you all can see it. I multiply with g inverse to the a. So I multiply this on the one hand with g to the a is the same as g inverse to the a times g to the b. Okay, now what is this? If I multiply here g inverse, I have a copies of g inverse there, and I have a copies of g there. So what I get is, one by one, they eat up each other, right? So I get the identity here. What happens here? A g inverse eats up a g here. The next g inverse eats up the next g there, and so forth. But b was bigger than a, so what remains is g to the b minus a. And for these products, the rules for multiplication there are exactly as the rules for exponents as you know them. It works out exactly the same way. So this is g to the b minus a. That is the identity. So I know the order of g is at most b minus a, right? So there exists a number, namely b minus a, so that g to the b minus a is the identity. And the order can't be bigger, because the order is the smallest such number, if they exist. So I can conclude that the order of g is at most b minus a. But what is b minus a? B is at most m plus 1, and a is at most 1, because that's where I started, right? I started with g, which is g to the 1. So b minus a can be at most m. Can be at most m plus 1 minus 1, which is m. So I have seen if my group has a finite order m, every element in this group can have at most order m. And we will see later that it actually must have an order dividing m. But that will take a while. So that's the order of an element. And I think that's, and I don't think it occurred on the homework, which is due on Friday, but it certainly occurs on the homework for next week. Order of an element. Yeah?
Multiple elements can have order of m, or only one element?
There could be multiple elements could have the same order. So for example, when I looked at the symmetries of the squares, I had two elements which had order 4. It could even happen that they have the order of the group. So for example, if you only look at the rotational symmetries of the square, you don't allow reflections. So you look at the symmetries which keep the front in the front. What symmetries do you have now? Then if you move one corner, if I move this corner one to one place, I know immediately where it has to be, right? So I have four possibilities, so I have four symmetries. So my group has order four. But the elements I know already, because this is just a subset of the elements which I have before. So I have this element, the 90 degree rotation has order four, and the other 90 degree rotation has also order four. So there are two elements of that order. What we will see a bit later is one can actually give a formula. How many are there? In this case, it basically what you need is a condition, we won't give a formula in all the case, but in some case you get a certain GCD condition on things. Right, there was another question.
If we look at this, your example of S square, that N...
Okay, sorry, this is SN, this is the symmetric group on N letters, so this is not symmetries of an N-gon. This is all the permutations of N points. Right? So in the case, the example where I had the symmetries of a square, these were permutations on four points, but not all permutations. Because there are 24 permutations in total, and I just had eight of them.
Because you can't totally reorder everything.
Because if I want to keep symmetries of the square, I can't say I want to move these two neighboring corners now to opposite corners. That would break the symmetry of the square. So often if I want permutations are convenient for describing symmetries of objects, but if my object is not just a set, I mean, here in some way my object is something which doesn't have any structure. It's just a set of elements 1 to n. As soon as my object has structure, like saying my object is the corners, I look at the corners of the square, I have a certain structure there. This structure typically imposes that not all permutations are valid as symmetries, because some of them might break the structure which I want to preserve. Right. Was there another question? No? So we have groups, we have their elements, we have element orders. And now, for a little while, we go basically along the same, well, or in some, it comes up again. We go along similar themes as we did with rings. So we now look at subsets of a group, which are, again, groups. And we did this with rings. There we call it subrings. So here we call it subgroups. Okay. So, definition, let G be a group, a non-empty subset, subset S is a subset of G, is called a subgroup. Of G, if S is a group with the same operation as for the same operation as G. I mean, on some sets I can define different operations. So if G is a group on the, say, G is the rational numbers under addition, I can't say now I consider the positive rational numbers under multiplication, because that is a different operation. So I need to take the same operation, but if I have a subset which is under the same operation, again a group, we call it a subgroup. And we write in this case, we write S, and now we use the same symbol as for subring, So this symbol now means subgroup. Yeah, you might wonder, okay, I'm using the same symbol. Isn't there the possibility for confusion? Yes and no. There would be the possibility of confusion if I would just write down this single symbol and ask you, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything on itself. Basically, if we are talking about rings, it means subring. If we are talking about groups, it means subgroup. And in general, we will not encounter just the symbol alone while wandering around somewhere without any context. So the context defines whether we mean subgroup or subring. Clearly, if we take a ring, I said every ring can be considered as a group. If we just take the addition in the ring as the operation, clearly every subring will automatically be a subgroup. But it is possible that a ring has more subgroups than just the ones which come from subrings. Okay. This concept is really, it's exactly the same idea as subrings, just in the case of groups. Before giving you examples, it's worth to just establish a criterion. When is something a subring? Sorry, not a subring, a subgroup. And this criterion is basically the same, well, it's almost the same criterion as you had for a subring. What you just do is you take the subring criterion and you forget about the part which had to do with multiplication. Okay, so if you forget about this part, let's say S, we don't want it to be the empty set. Let's say this is a subset of a group G. Then S is a subgroup of G if and only if the following properties hold. Okay, since I demand that it's not the empty set, I don't need to write down empty set as an extra property. So what do we have? We want that if we take two elements and we operate with them together, that the result is again in there. So for all elements A and B in S, I have that A operation with B is again in S. Second property, I want that for every element, the inverse is in there for all A and B, for all A in S, I have that the inverse, and now I just write it as A inverse. With rings, we wrote it as minus A because we considered the operation more as an addition. Here, I consider it more as a multiplication, so that's why I write it as A inverse is in S. Okay. And with rings, we also had something that not just the addition, but also the multiplication that is closed under multiplication. I don't need to check this here because I don't have a second operation. I just have one operation. If you look at books, and this is again similar to what happens with rings, one can combine one and two into one condition. And let me just note this. Note, one can combine one and two to the following condition. For all elements A and B in the group G, I have that A times B, sorry, in the set S, I have that A times B inverse is in S. Books list this, and then sometimes they get very excited. Look, this is an easier test. It's just one condition we have to test. But if you look at it in practice, it isn't really such a treat as they make it look. And the reason is simply to multiply A with B inverse, you first need to compute B inverse. And once you have B inverse, you can typically check pretty easily that it is in there. So the amount of work you need to do for this, I'm willing to bet, is in 95% or more of all cases, not less work than trying to do the two things. But since the books mention it, I mean, it might be once or so convenient to do. I wanted to mention. Okay. So let me give a proof for this theorem. Why is such a set a subgroup? Well, condition one tells me S is closed under the operation. One guarantees S is closed under the operation. Okay. Because S is not empty, I know there exists an element in S. There exists an element, let's call it X, in S. By condition two, I have that also X inverse is in S. And by condition one, I have that X times X inverse is in S. And X times X inverse is the identity element. So I have an identity element in S. This is the identity element of the whole group, right? But that will work as identity with all elements of the whole group. So clearly it must work as identity elements with all elements from the subset S. So that gives me the identity, and condition two gives the existence of inverses. No. X times X inverse is the identity, the identity I call again E. Right? I take an arbitrary element. I know by condition two its inverse is in there. And by condition one, the product of the element with its inverse has to be in there. And that product is the identity. And two gives the existence of inverses. And the pesky associativity of the multiplication, I don't need to show because I inherit this automatically from the group G. The same idea as with rings. And that's part of the reason why I mentioned this symmetric group Sn, because once we've established that this is a group, whenever we work with permutations, we just need to show that it is a subgroup. We don't need to show that it's a group, it wasn't really much work because I just talked about the associativity there, but it just makes things easier. And similarly, the general linear group, the group of all invertible matrices, if we have a group of matrices, we can just argue that it is a subgroup. Okay, so that's definition of a subgroup and the condition for being a subgroup. So with this condition, let me give you some examples. Of such subgroups. So we could take for G all the integers with addition as operation, and we could take for S all the even integers that is a subgroup. Why is it a subgroup? Well, it's clearly not empty. The number zero, for example, is even. If I take two even integers and I take the operation. Operation is addition. The sum of two even integers is again even. So the sum lies in there. The negative of an even integer is again even. So the negative lies in, the inverse lies in there. So therefore, the even integers form a subgroup. Yeah? Okay, careful. This was not subring, this was ideal, right? Okay, we haven't yet had the corresponding thing for ideal. Okay, we just have this corresponding thing to subring. And the only thing which looks slightly different is what we write as multiplication now was the addition in the ring. So what we drop is the second operation for the ring, which for the ring we wrote as multiplication, but now we write the one operation as multiplication. And we write it as multiplication simply that in some way this is just laziness. If you write multiplication, the convention is that you don't even write the symbol, but that you just write the things near each other, that you write AB and you mean A times B, and so you don't need to write the operation symbol. So that's why we, if we have one, we consider it as multiplication. Okay. One last 10-second example. If I take for G the symmetric group as 4, all the permutations on 4 letters, then I have a subgroup in there, the symmetries of the square. If I consider them as permutations. Right? They are permutations on 4 points. We had written them down. So they are clearly a subset. It's clearly not empty. And it's closed under the operations. So this is another example of a subgroup. And if you need to show that something is a group, if you know that it's a subset of a bigger group, you can just show that it is a subgroup. You don't need, so that saves you going through the associativity, basically. Right. Thank you very much. And I see you on Friday.